going on, Elite Mafia? This is Vlad Sedler and Peter Christensen, RotoGut and Draft Chief, coming to you with a podcast here for as we get ready for the regular season. Draft season is officially over. DC is big main event draft. I just got back from Vegas with some draft. So how you doing today, Pete, first of all?
I'm good, man. We made it. Baseball season is here. As you mentioned, I had my my first ever NFBC main event draft last night, and it's 8:30 in the morning here, so I'm still nursing just a little bit of a hangover, you know, drinking the beers and live tweeting the entire thing. Was a very fun night.
I got to say, that was by far the most entertaining draft I'd ever seen, especially, you know, when it came down to, like, Kevin Pillar. You're like, I've got no gifts for this guy. I've got nothing to say, just a boring pick.
Yeah, I tried to, you know, there was some brags, some projections in the tweets, yeah. And then a little bit of humor when I had a pick that I, you know, sometimes you just gotta make a boring-ass Kevin Pillar pick, and you're not super proud of it. You don't have a lot of analysis to make, but you just want your 15 homers and 15 steals.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you, because I'd asked you after the draft was over, I'm like, dude, how do you feel? Because I know that sometimes sitting there for 4 hours and doing a draft is can make you really tired, can be really taxing. I actually got trolled by one of these golf DFS experts. He's like, dude, you drafted 12 hours in a 30-hour span. Like, how are you tired? Like, I'm like, first of all, bro, I'm mentally tired. It's not physical. It's not like I'm sitting there exhausted and, like, out of breath. And third of all, like, I don't know, I use this draft software, so I'm tracking the entire draft, and I know you're not this crazy, but I'm sitting there entering every single one of people's picks. And if you maybe enter the wrong name, you got to go back and, like, put the guys in. And obviously I've been drafting all these years, just, you know, I can just draft. That's no problem. And I can eyeball my targets and categories. But for me, it was helpful to put all that information in and basically track, you know, so I could track it over the course of the whole season. But it also, you know, I'm inputting my targets in there. So during the middle of the draft, I have a good idea of, like, okay, I know I'm short in stolen bases, but how short am I, and that sort of thing. So I'm guessing with you, I know you had all projections pretty much memorized. You pretty much knew what you were doing. So maybe not the same.
Yeah, we use that same Roto Lab software, and I certainly have, you know, a custom projection in for every player. And I did use that during some of the online championships, you know, leading up to this. But by yesterday, I'm just, like, so overly prepared and just so, like, I don't know, I've just been studying baseball for, like, 2 months. And I pretty much have, like, every single player's projection memorized. Like, you know, it's like I know if it's, like, 42 or 44 steals, and it's certainly helpful to insert all that stuff into RotoLab and kind of see where you are, but at this point, it would become more of a burden than it would be worth.
So you ended up in this main event. First of all, for those that don't play, these main events, there ended up being 37 this year. 2 weekends ago, there were, like, I think, 3 drafts in New York live, 1 in Chicago live, and some onlines. This past weekend were a whole bunch of main events, I think, like, 7 of them or something like that, all taking place at the same time in Vegas. I was there for one of them, drafting out of the 14th spot. And then they've had a few more onlines over the last couple of days. I think they have maybe one more day of those. But it's a $1,700 entry, $6,500 to the league winner. It pays second and third as well. And then there's a grand prize of $150K, which I know both you and I are chomping at the bit to get a piece of. But you got this first main event draft that you've done, and you ended up with the 10 pick. I mean, how happy were you with that, and kind of what was your plan going on? I mean, did what you get end up being what you were looking for?
For the most part. So as we talked about on our previous pod that we recorded a couple weeks ago, in NFBC, there is a Kentucky Derby setting. So you kind of get to choose your pick preference, and then, you know, it simulates, runs through a computer, and, you know, basically assigns a pick preference to everyone in the draft. And so I got the 10th, you know, my 10th preference, which ended up being the number 10 pick. So not ideal, but totally fine. We've discussed, you know, I really do think you can win from anywhere picking this year. I think there are strong picks throughout the first round. So I was really hoping to get Ronald Acuna with the 10th pick yesterday. And then my second choice was Trevor Story, who I did end up getting. And I ended up I pretty much knew coming into the draft that I was going to punt batting average entirely, basically planning to get essentially 0 points, even in the overall, out of my batting average stat. And so I needed a player basically that's super strong in power and speed, and I wasn't so focused on batting average. And I did almost abandon the plan because, kind of surprisingly, at number 10, both Christian Yelich and JD Martinez were available. They don't usually slide quite that far, especially Yelich. And I almost went for Christian Yelich. I don't have any shares of him so far just because he's always going like pick 4, 5, 6. But I basically would have had to throw my entire plan out the window because Yelich, obviously one of his strengths is batting average, and you're kind of paying for that to some degree. So I decided to stick with it, go with Story at 10, which is quite a bit higher than he typically goes.
So this is a crazy, crazy draft board, and I know the dude that was picking at 15, Michael Edelman.
The dude that was picking at 13 is the question.
Carl Jung?
Well, he picked Juan Soto in the first round, which is interesting.
Yeah. So what that ended up leading to, and especially Machado going 14th, is that Edelman ended up getting Martinez and Aaron Judge at the 15, 16 turn. I mean, every draft is its own, like, different beast and animal, but this is the type of league, man, I would have loved to get in. Like, you know, people really didn't love the 15 picks this year. You know, me drafting out of 14, I'm like, hey, I'm just going to do whatever I can out of it. And this dude just lands on this perfect combo. And I really don't mind what he did afterwards. I mean, he got Rendon, who's one of my favorite targets, at that, you know, 45, 46 turn, the 3-4 round, and paired him with Clevinger, who is also one of my favorite targets. So it's a really interesting start there. But you in the second round, picking out of pick 10, you ended up getting, you know, second round picks 21. It looked like three pitchers had just gone off the board. A very early Walker Buehler pick. Like, I'm all good with Walker Buehler if he's going in the mid-30s. But this same dude that took Juan Soto took him at 18 overall. So he starts off with Soto, Buehler. Our boy Bauer, who I think we have common love for, went two picks before you. Verlander, the pick right before you. Was there any point you were considering a pitcher? Because Gerrit Cole had gone 9 overall in my league. He's still sitting there at the second round. Did you consider him, or did you have a specific plan in mind of how you were attacking him?
No, I didn't consider any of the pitchers that were on the board when it was my turn to pick at 21. I was hoping to get Trevor Bauer there. I would have taken Trevor Bauer at 21. You know, looking at kind of previous main events, I thought there was maybe a 70 to 80% chance Bauer would fall to me at 21. So I was disappointed to lose out on him. He went two picks before me, as you mentioned. And then I may have taken Verlander at 21, but he went the pick before me. So at that point, you know, my plan was thrown off just a little bit. I actually did end up getting like 70 to 80% of the players that I wanted throughout this draft. Kind of, I mapped it out round by round, every player I wanted, and most of it fell into place, but not this. So I did have to pivot. Giancarlo Stanton was obviously not on the top of my list for round two here, but, you know, I mentioned I was kind of dead set on punting batting average in this draft. And so Giancarlo Stanton is obviously a pretty good player for that strategy, right? Tons of power, RBIs, runs, not much speed, of course, but a huge power threat in the middle of that Yankees lineup and not a good batting average. That's his weakness. So I was happy to get him there at 21.
Yeah, I mean, Story Stanton gives you a really nice power base. You're getting some steals. Not the ideal average start, but hey, let me tell you, and you and I talked about this beforehand, you pretty much said, hey, I'm going to be punting batting average and kind of let the chips fall where they may there. That's the strategy that Lindy Hingelman did when he won I think he still does it this way. He won two main overalls, including one year where he won the main and the overall and ended up getting a 75K bonus. So it's not a bad strategy at all. I'll catch up with my solo draft that I did on Sunday from pick 8 because we ended up with the same third round pick. For me, I was actually kind of surprised and wasn't planning on it. At 8, I was planning to take the best hitter available. I would have loved the JD Martinez to fall to me, even though he doesn't really steal bases. I really don't have enough of that Boston middle of the lineup exposure. But I ended up with Jacob DeGrom. And honestly, you know, people might think I draft pitching earlier more than I should, and we know how much pitching gets pushed up in these leagues. But this is my first time ever drafting a pitcher in the first round. I've pretty much never touch the Kershaws or the Scherzers of the world in the past, I'd always take a hitter. But that kind of gave me a nice solid base, hoping that a good hitter would fall in the second. And that's exactly what happened when Bryce Harper fell. And that was a very tough call because I love Giancarlo Stanton. I have some exposure to him in a bunch of my onlines in the second round. And I'm actually one of the few crazy people in this world that actually has him slightly over Judge. And I know that must sound absolutely wild to people, but for whatever reason, just, you know, maybe half a dollar value more than Judge. So, but Harper was fine for me there in the second. And since we both kind of drafted around the same spot in the third round, I got my first Mondesi share in a very long time. And it looks like you did too, but this is your flat out plan, right? I mean, you were going to get this guy because he's like a top 15 guy for you.
Oh yeah. I mean, I was praying for Adalberto Mondesi here. You know, part of the reason why I thought punting batting average was the best strategy. You know, you run, obviously you make your projections for each player, and then, you know, that's part of the valuation. And the second part of the valuation is figuring out, you know, what those projections are worth in each stat category. And so I've got, you know, a spreadsheet of who I think are the biggest values overall. And then also, once you remove batting average, who are the biggest values? And once I did that, I've got Mondesi as the fourth most valuable hitter. Once you take out batting average out of the equation in fantasy baseball. And so getting him at pick 40 was really critical to kind of the execution of this strategy. Obviously you picked him at 3-2. I mean, I think in the third round as well, for me, Mondesi, I know people are saying he's risky. Oh, like the on-base percentage could be so low that he gets sent down to the minor leagues or gets benched or gets moved back to the nine hole. Like, I don't see that at all. I really don't think he's very risky. I think he's got an outside chance at like 25 home runs and 60 steals, which he would contend for the top overall value in fantasy baseball if he does pull that off. If you extrapolate his numbers from last year, I think it's like, I wrote this in the article, it's like 32 steals or 32 home runs and 80 steals. People think that Mondesi is some like slap Billy Hamilton type hitter, and it's just not the truth. The dude has legit power from both sides of the plate. And yeah, I love getting him here at 40.
So the only thing is, when I was in Vegas, obviously your arch nemesis, Siege, was there. And so, you know, obviously had a bunch of time that we hung around and talking players. And first of all, yelling at him about Tyler O'Neill, who I think is actually going to be good. And, you know, he claims to have his inside information. And that.
Oh, Siege claiming inside information. I never would have guessed.
So that he's not going to have any Tyler O'Neill this year. Thinks, you know, the team doesn't like him. But besides that, he's a huge, huge Mondesi fan. So does that jinx Mondesi for us, or do you think there's enough Mondesi to go around for all of us?
Hey, a broken clock is right twice a day, right?
This is true. Yeah, I'm in agreement with you. I mean, I think, you know, there's a time and place for everything, but, you know, a guy with his upside and, you know, the way that you and I play, and I think most people play these leagues, it is – the main event is we're not looking to just try to win our league, right? And it's not just about the money. I mean, obviously, $6,500 is really cool. To win your main event is obviously a big deal, but we're looking to be the overall champions, right? And you're not going to do that drafting, you know, the Kyle Seegers of the world, if you will, like all these, you know, Anthony Rizzos, all these boring guys that, you know, that aren't going to move that bottom line. Mondesi is one of those guys with tremendous upside that can be a difference maker. And if you're getting him in the third round, you're getting a really crap ton of upside.
Yeah, exactly. He's, you know, I'm looking for players throughout the draft that I think can, you know, return value many rounds ahead of where they're being drafted. Obviously, if you're in the third round, you know, the highest you can get is to the first round, but Mondesi very, very clearly can end up being a first round player. And, you know, I would say most of the players drafted in the third round could be, but I don't think most can approach, you know, being the top overall player like Mondesi's upside is.
So you went with back-to-back closers at 4-5. The thing that most people have noticed looking at these main event draft boards is, you know, people have been pushing up pitcher. I mean, you had your guy at 6, ended up going Chris Sale in the first round, Gerrit Cole in the second. You know, in my draft, the guy that picked right after me took Garrett Cole in the ninth, Blake Snell, or ninth overall, Blake Snell in the second round. Like, people are really afraid of these pitchers going. And I know, you know, you had a different strategy last year and you did well in the online leagues where you really didn't even take a pitcher until, you know, quite a while later. There really is a lot to sometimes zagging when other people are zigging. And it looks like that's kind of what you did, because didn't look like you were in fear of missing out with those guys because you pretty much knew who your targets were. You didn't take a starting pitcher until the eighth round. You went back-to-back with Masahiro Tanaka and Chris Archer. But in four and five, you went back-to-back bomb-ass closers, Blake Treinen and Roberto Zuna. Basically, my favorite closers in all of baseball this year, and I think possibly yours too.
Yeah, Blake Treinen, you try to kind of plan out your drafts, these big money drafts. You try to figure out where you're going to go in each round to some extent, but it's difficult, right? You don't know if someone's going to get sniped, especially in these main events where ADP doesn't really seem to mean a lot. And we kind of saw that in this, this draft with Soto going 13. I missed out on Trevor Bauer. I was hoping to get him in second round. But one pick I did know for sure that I was going to make was Blake Treinen in the fourth at pick 51. I set a new high, I believe, in the main event for Blake Treinen. He had not gone as high as 51 yet. I've got him as by far the best closer in baseball coming into 2019. Made some changes. People don't realize he made some changes halfway through last year that made him even better. So you look at his season last year, you know, you can't project him for an ERA under one again or whatever he had, but I think he's going to put up 35 saves and 7-8 wins. He's got the ability to go a couple innings. I think he'll pitch more innings than any other closer on a pretty good team in Oakland, and he's just phenomenal. So I knew I was going to get Blake Treinen at 51. I was comfortable setting a high on him. And then Ozuna was that was maybe one of the picks I'm not as happy with throughout this draft. I'm totally fine with it. He's an elite closer, like you mentioned, for the Astros. No worries with him performance-wise or anything like that. But I did really want my boy Herman Marquez there, my kind of dark horse. And Elsa Young, I've written articles about him, kind of been banging that drum all offseason. And he went two picks before me at pick 68. So that was disappointing to kind of lose out on kind of my two favorite pitchers going into 2019. That's Trevor Bauer and Herman Marquez. But, you know, shit happened. So you pivot to another good closer like Roberto Ozuna. And like you mentioned, I'm pretty high on getting these elite closers. I think people, you know, I hear a lot of analysis about, you know, closers, oh, will he be able to keep his job? Is he good enough to keep his job? What I don't hear enough about is, like, the damage that bad closers can do to your ratios. Mm-hmm. And you know, the good that guys like Treinen and Ozuna can do to your ratios, along with the saves, of course, which are scarce. But I really do love those elite closers that are going to give you ERAs below three and whips, you know, maybe below one.
Yeah, I mean, it really is true. I mean, there are people that are in, you know, dumpster diving. They've got their Shane Green and, maybe even Jordan Hicks, who could blow up some ratios or could end up being really good, and like Greg Holland, and you're really playing with fire. And what happens is, especially in a year like this, where, I mean, literally there are only maybe 15 to 20 teams that have a secure closing situation, and you can only even really trust half of those guys. Like, getting really amazing ratios from guys like Treinen and Ozuna, I think, is very undervalued. I mean, Roberto Ozuna has actually never had a whip under one in any year of his career. And we saw what Blake Treinen did. I mean, it wasn't just lucky that he had a 150 ERA. I mean, these are two absolute beasts. And the other thing is, having a couple of closers like that not only give a good anchor for your ratios for the overall of this game, but also you're probably not having to circle spending a whole bunch of money in fab all season. And closers aren't cheap. I mean, some of these guys don't even stick. We saw Jacob Barnes last year for the Brewers early on. You know, people were spending upwards of $250. He got one save. Then Jeffers came in and other guys came in, you know, Hader and stuff. And you know, it was basically a waste of money. And there are always these situations every year where people spending a whole bunch of money in free agent dollars on guys that basically blow up your ratios, then don't even keep the job, and you end up being really screwed. So there's a lot of safety in having a couple of guys like that. So yeah. I think those are great picks.
The downside on the kind of the dumpster diving closers strategy is, you know, I mean, it's just like a, it's like a triple headed monster, right? You spend a fairly high pick on the player. And then if things don't go well, they're going to give you like, you know, like a 5 or 6 ERA, like a 1.8 whip, and then lose their job and not get any saves. And they just like, they crushed your team. You wasted the pick. They killed your ratios and they didn't give you the saves that you drafted. And so I do think spending up on these closers, I know it's, you know, it's a couple of high picks to spend on closers. You know, there's guys, some pretty damn good hitters and starting pitchers around here that you have to pass on, but I do think it's worth it. And the truth of the matter is, I mean, these closers, these elite closers are the most scarce asset in the draft. I mean, there are starting pitchers that are reasonable pitchers that could break out as far down as, you know, round 24, 25, 26. There's no elite closers down there. They just don't exist. So I think spending up is a good strategy.
Yeah. And for me, I mean, you know, this is kind of the no man's land. I feel every year, like between sort of pick 60 through 90, there's just a lot of guys that are all very similar. You know, I was mentioning it in my article, like I never really went out of my way for a Eugenio Suarez at 50 overall or Miguel Andujar, because I've got guys who I project for similar stuff going like 150, 200 picks later. So for me, I think this is a prime position to, you know, build up some starting pitching, you know, grab a big bat like you have, like a Gallo, or for me for a while, it was Olsen before he got hurt. So, you know, that totally makes a lot of sense. You and I both have Luke Voit, and we took him in the same spot in the 11th round. First base is kind of a weird position. It's like, if you don't get Goldie or Freeman, you know, you've got your other guys like Aguiar and Abreu later. Even Joey Votto, who wasn't a target of mine, but I ended up on a couple of big teams where I needed batting average. But Luke Voit is one of those guys who could be an absolute monster, right? I mean, you and I were talking about the other day between, you know, guys like him and Max Muncy. We saw a flash of what Voit could do last year, prospect of the Cardinals, but he legitimately could be one of these best hitters on the Yankees, no?
Yeah, I mean, you know, he was traded from the Cardinals to the Yankees, I think in mid-August of last season. And since the time he was traded, he literally led the entire league, all of MLB, in barrels per plate appearance. The other leaders in that stat, you know, last couple of years are Giancarlo Stanton and Aaron Judge and, you know, Joey Gallo and just all the best hitters, Bryce Harper, all the best hitters. Mike Trout, all the best hitters in baseball are essentially leading that stat. And yes, it was only for, you know, that 40, 45 day period at the end of the year. But I mean, the Yankees were in a playoff hunt at that time. He kind of continued it into the playoffs, has come out mashing this spring. Aaron Boone has said he likes him in the cleanup spot, right? I mean, this dude might hit cleanup for the Yankees all year long. If he does, he's going to have a monster stat line for a player that you can get at pick 160. And for me, you know, punting batting average, I kind of knew I wasn't going to, you know, in round two, I passed on guys like Goldschmidt and Freddie Freeman because first base, you know, people have been saying it's kind of a shallow position this year. And I do agree with that to some extent, but I knew that I was punting batting average. And so I knew there was going to be a bunch of people, a bunch of players kind of around, you know, pick 160 and beyond, guys like Voit, Peter Alonso, who I also ended up getting, Carlos Santana, a bunch of these guys that are going to hit in the middle of the lineup and are low batting average guys. But when you're not concerned with that, I knew I could wait on first base. And I was really, really happy to get Luke Voit. And I know you got him in round 11. I think I took him a similar round.
Yep, same spot.
Yep, we both got him round 11. I don't know. I mean, there's some downside there, right? He could potentially lose his job to a guy like Greg Bird if he starts out slow. But the upside is immense for a pick in round 11, no doubt.
Yeah, I mean, in just in general, I mean, in terms of some of these starting pitchers, I know you and I, you know, you're one of the best pitching dudes I know. So I'm always paying attention to the guys that you're interested in. And that's actually why you're able to wait in season-long drafts on some of these guys. But I see a lot of similarities in terms of guys we drafted or targeted. But, like, I didn't personally end up with any John Gray shares. But everything to me screams, you know, positive regression this year. Even though he's in Colorado, he was somebody I was looking to target. Sonny Gray, somebody who had an absolutely horrendous year last year. For whatever reason, it just makes a lot of sense. I know he's had a great spring, and we shouldn't go off of just that. But Sonny Gray, I think even though he's in a tough park, is someone that can actually have a really good season here in the NL. Michael Pineda, I ended up having some shares. You got him in the 18th round, I think is a really good value. I know everyone keeps talking about it, but it's something I like to keep hammering in drafts, is the good pitchers in the AL Central are in a really, really good spot because this is a horrible division. I mean, we're talking about, you know, the White Sox and the Royals who are going to run a lot and aren't necessarily going to smash you. The Twins really look like the best hitting team in this yep. division. And I mean, like, what are the Indians now? I mean, imagine if Jose Ramirez had actually gotten hurt or Lindor was out longer. I mean, they're starting guys like Taylor Naquin and Greg Allen and even the ghost of Hanley Ramirez and the corpse of Carlos Gonzalez. Like, you know, what's going on with these Indians?
No, exactly. I was going to say, especially the Twins pitchers. I mean, the Indians pitchers are better pitchers, but I think the Twins clearly have the strongest offense in the division. So the Twins pitchers are just going to get good matchup after good matchup. They pitch in a pretty nice park. You know, it's obviously fairly cool, which is good for run prevention most of the year. And then I think the one thing that's going underrated a little bit with the Twins pitchers is the elite outfield defense, especially behind them. Byron Buxton, the best center fielder, in my opinion, in the league, and looks like he's going to, you know, at least to start the year, be healthy and play every day. Kepler's good in right field. Rosario, good athlete in left field. So especially for a guy like Michael Pineda, who, you know, he's always had kind of elite strikeout and walk rates pitching in New York. But the big issue was just so many home runs, a high batting average on balls in play. You know, you put that outfield defense behind him in a better park to pitch in and, you know, a much weaker schedule. And I think those home runs and, you know, a high batting average allowed are going to go down significantly. If you can keep the strikeout and walk rates that he had in New York, I mean, we're talking a potential top 20 pitcher here out of Pineda, getting him pretty late. So I was excited about that.
Yeah, and so for the late round starting pitchers, I think a lot of it, at least this week, and we'll talk about it towards the end of the show here, was, you know, for me, it weren't just targets that I'm looking, you know, to kind of hopefully catch lightning with a, you know, in a bottle and for the entire season, but also guys that have some advantageous schedules early on, some guys that I can take advantage of matchups. Like for me, I'm not necessarily the biggest Marcus Stroman guy. But, I mean, when he was healthy a couple years ago, I mean, in the AL, because of his incredible ground ball rate, he was able to keep his ERA around 3. Not a lot of strikeouts out of the guy. But if you're looking at his early season schedule, he's getting, like, you know, Detroit and just all these incredible matchups. I mean, if everything plays right, he's off to a very good start for you. Brad Keller, somebody that I got in Fab last year in the Platinum Draft, for maybe like $3, ended up becoming very valuable. And I'm looking at, obviously, I don't think a 3.2 ERA is going to be sustainable. Like last year, his, you know, FIP was a little higher, but it really isn't that much difference. I mean, he is the opening day starter for a reason. I see you ended up grabbing him as well.
Yeah, I pretty much grabbed him in the 29th round for that opening day start at home against the White Sox. I was like, all right, I'll roll him out there and see what happens.
Exactly. And that's what you're doing with some of these guys here. I mean, you know, for me, you know, some other pitchers that we're looking at, like, you know, Felix Pena, Frankie Montes, guys that showed a little bit last year, have some upside. Some of these Atlanta guys that are going to be in the rotation now, Kyle Wright and possibly Bryce Wilson, Max Fried, I think had like a monster double-digit start. I don't know if you used him for DFS that one game where he had like 11, 12 strikeouts or something, but there's some good guys there in the late rounds.
Yeah, just looking at your solo main event, the pitchers that you grabbed, we disagree a little bit about Clayton Kershaw, but obviously we're pretty good risk at round 6. Nick Pivetta in round 9, tons of upside there, great stuff. I mean, most of your guys that you got are guys that have really good stuff, and those are the guys that, you know, they can put it together if they're able to just dial in their command a little bit or change up their pitch sequencing or their pitch mix, you know, the percentage of times they throw each pitch. So I love your picks. Pivetta, Matt Strom, I think, is a really strong breakout candidate out in San Diego. Corbin Burns going to be in that Milwaukee rotation. He's got a big arm. Marcus Stroman, as you mentioned, good stuff. Has kind of been up and down, but clearly upside is there. Freed Pomeranz, possible bounce back season. Moving from Boston to San Francisco doesn't get much better than that. So, love the staff that you put together in that main event that you did a couple days ago. And just tons of upside up and down that roster.
Yeah, so we both kind of have the same plan in mind. You told me before the draft, you're like, dude, I'm not drafting a catcher until the 29th round. I'm going to make my last two picks, 29 and 30. So you ended up with three catchers, which is good. Hedges in the 23rd is going to be splitting some time with Mejia, but obviously he's got that 20 home run pop. Kurt Suzuki in the 25th, who I think is, you know, I think he's better than Yan Gomes. I think he's going to probably get more playing time than him. Just a really solid pick there. And yeah, then
I'm seeing everyone project Gomes for more playing time than Suzuki, but for me, they're somewhat similar defensive catchers. Neither of them are great there. And Suzuki's clearly the better hitter. So that's kind of what I'm hoping for with that pick.
Yeah. And the thing is, what I've learned with second catchers, like almost all season long, like I don't understand. I remember a few years ago, people were like trying to go heavy catchers with a position scarcity thing and grab all the Posies and the Luke Roys. But if those guys hurt, man, I mean, you're really getting crushed with your fourth, fifth round pick. Yeah. I mean, what's the point of grabbing a catcher that's going to be playing, you know, basically two-thirds of those games anyway? So it's better to kind of stream these guys. I mean, you have Suzuki, you have Blake Swihart. You can look ahead with NFBC. I mean, it's basically set where you're making your hitter lineup changes twice a week. So if you have an idea based on split platoons that Swihart's going to get two of the next three guys over the weekend, then you know who your play is. It's better kind of playing those guys for a couple of games that have a good matchup, as opposed to like just streaming a Zunino all year, where you're probably going to get killed with a .220 batting average and may even miss out on his like home run ditch.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't be shocked if none of Hedges, Suzuki and Swihart are on my team, you know, 2 months into the season. It's just like, what's interesting, you mentioned, you know, you lose so many at bats when you take a catcher high on a high pick, like a Gary Sanchez, like even him, you know, the most he's going to play is 4 out of 5 days. I did consider Sanchez just because he was such a good fit for my strategy. He's, you know, all power, no batting average, but still one thing that people forget, like position players generally stay pretty healthy. Catchers do not. I mean, I think the injury rate for catchers is something like four times that of what it is for your average position player. So you're going to spend a, you know, a fourth, fifth round pick on a guy like Sanchez or Real Muto. That's a big risk. They have just a much higher chance of getting hurt than other position players that you could spend that pick on. So I do think just going ahead and punting catcher, for me, does seem like the proper strategy, especially if the low batting average of some of these guys can't really hurt you.
Exactly. And I wanted to ask you about some of this fallen value on the Padres, because everybody knows how crowded that outfield situation is. So, I mean, how do you even attack something like that? I know that Franmil Reyes is kind of the popular guy there. He went in the 14th round in my draft. But for me, you know, somebody like Hunter Renfro, who's got 30 home run upside, obviously isn't going to play every day. He's just going to play against one, you know, one side of the, you know, basically just lefties. Like, he just kept falling. Like, I was looking to take him in the 14th. He ended up falling all the way to the 16th. So I got him. And then Manny Margot, who I think's got some upside with stolen bases, right? And it's just a matter of, you know, is he going to get any playing time? So, you know, Margot last year, where he was a 10th rounder, was an absolute joke, but now you're talking about 24th, 25th round, and these reserve rounds is a really good place to see if maybe there's some lightning in the bottle that can end up sticking for you.
Yeah, I like the talent of all the San Diego guys, and I'm with you. I think generally drafting, you know, kind of talent over sure playing time can be a good strategy. But I was a little bit hesitant to do it at this point when we're just a couple days out from the regular season starting, and all these guys are on the team. They're all healthy. I mean, you look at the San Diego outfield, they've got Will Myers, who I think we both agree is probably going to play pretty much every day, just because he's kind of the established guy there. But then you've got Margot, Franmil Reyes, Hunter Renfro, and Franchi Cordero, all of those guys I think would be starting outfielders for most teams in the league. So I think people were anticipating, you know, maybe one of these guys being traded off the team. You know, there's rumors for Bauer or Kluber for Cleveland, and, you know, something like that could still happen. But, like, I want to get off to a good start in these leagues, you know. And are Margot or Renfro, I think it's going to be kind of rare that they're ever, like, super strong starts, because you might only get, you know, one or two games out of them. Especially Renfro, I'm a little bit worried. But the upside is there. You know, if he can claim that spot, I mean, the dude could hit 40 home runs. He has just insane power.
Yeah, I was going to say, one of the things is obviously mining for value really deep in drafts. But why was it that a guy like Ben Zobrist, who, ironically, both you and I picked up in the 20th
round. I didn't realize you picked him until until I'm looking at your draft today.
Yeah, but it's like, what is he doing here? I mean, if you're looking at depth charts, he's literally, maybe not every day, he's the leadoff hitter for the Cubs, and the dude pretty much always hits 290, 300. So what the hell is he doing? Like, you need a middle infielder, and you're at the end of your draft. I mean, does it get any better than that?
Yeah, I mean, he's not exciting. He's not going to win you the league, but right now he's projected to lead off for the Cubs. He's a good on-base percentage guy. He can still defend a little bit, steal a couple bags, a little bit of pop, score some runs. And especially after they sent Ian Happ down to the minor leagues, I think that kind of secured Zobrist playing time. I also like that he's second base outfield eligible. So for my team, at that point, 27th round, I believe I only had just Juan Moncada was my only guy that could play second base. So it's nice to have another guy you can slide in there on Friday in case something happens to Moncada.
And then just real quick before we pivot to the end of the show, just talk about a little preparation for, lineups and the opening of the season, our 30th round pick. So obviously there's a lot of guys that you could take with your 30th round pick. You can fill in some depth. You can grab another starting pitcher. I went with my boy Pablo Reyes, outfielder, second baseman for the Pittsburgh Pirates. I believe he's going to make the team, or so I hope. Listen, I may end up dropping him, but he's one of those guys that I feel it has that 15-15 potential and ability to provide you with a good batting average. You grabbed phenom pitcher Justice Sheffield for Seattle. So what about these final round picks there?
Yeah, I like your Reyes pick. He's been a guy that's been on my radar. I've got him in several of the draft champions, 50-round draft and holds. Fourth outfielder, I think, for the Pirates for the time being, but an injury away from really perhaps being an impact player, someone that could potentially hit at the top of that lineup. He's got some speed, good contact skills. So, yeah, definitely like the pick for Reyes at 30. And, you know, both of these picks, your Reyes pick, my Sheffield pick, I mean, our second waiver period is Sunday. Either of them could be off our team. You know, if there's someone that we need to pick up, then and you move on. But you want some upside there. Reyes certainly has it. Sheffield traded to the Mariners from the Yankees in the James Paxton deal. You know, got some pretty good minor league numbers, some pretty glowing reviews. Going to start the season in AAA for the Mariners, but pitch well this spring. And, I mean, the Mariners are rolling out guys like Felix Hernandez in the starting rotation still. So it does seem like it's mostly a matter of time before Sheffield comes up, and hopefully I'll be able to hold on to him until that point.
Yeah, so this is a very weird sort of start to the year. And for, you know, a lot of you that may be listening and playing NFBC and may have similar setups, the way it works is the games that happen in Japan, Oakland, and Seattle, those games do count. So if you have Hunter Strickland or you have Domingo Santana, that's very, very good. Same thing is why we saw Zach Ruskup, one of the guys that got the win in that series, getting drafted in the 25th, 26th round. People will just bank the win and then basically drop him. But also on the flip side, like if you have Omar Narvaez, you probably should have drafted a third catcher because he went 0-for-9 in that series. So you don't want to get off of that batting average start. So you drop him. Not drop him, but you know, you at least pick up somebody for, you know, to play for this week. But heading into this weekend, it's kind of a weird thing because there are a lot of really good starters that are like, you know, a team sport starter, but they could be your second starting pitcher that you need to make sure to get out of your lineup. And I think Mike Clevinger is one of the examples of that. Like, you know, they've got the weekend series, but he doesn't actually start till Monday. So he'll get two starts next week. But for this week, you got to be able to fill up that spot. And I think that's the case for a lot of other people, right? I mean, like, you know, Steven Matz doesn't go until Monday. Thankfully, it's, you know, against Miami. Same thing if you have Anibal Sanchez or possibly even Chris Archer, who I think gets the home opener against St. Louis next Monday. So people really have to be careful and make sure that you're fielding a full lineup of pitchers, and you get all nine spots filled if you can.
Yep, I did make that mistake in one or two of my online championships where I didn't quite. I'll have to roll a pitcher out there that, you know, won't. He's going to pitch on next week, get a two-start week. So that's definitely a good point and something to pay attention to. A couple guys that I have a lot of, Kyle Gibson won't start till Monday. Shane Bieber, another popular pick, won't start until next week. So do pay attention to that for those guys if you're in the NFBC or other leagues. We can switch. And then another thing, you know, we've talked about how you can switch out hitters on Friday. That's relevant this week because you can basically, you know, every single team plays Thursday on opening day. So pay attention to matchups for that first day, and then you can kind of switch out your hitters for the weekend too. I think people maybe will kind of forget that just because it's a short week anyway.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, just looking at matchups for this coming weekend, and I know, you know, we've got some DFS shows coming up. We've got, you know, all that stuff that we're going to be doing over at Elite Fantasy. But something that sticks out to me is Detroit's matchups. I mean, some of these hitters here, Jaime Candelario is somebody that I had been targeting late in drafts. And it just so happens he gets off to a pretty, you know, this Detroit team gets off to a pretty kick-ass start. Four games against Detroit. I mean, hopefully Stroman handles his business with them. But then they're pretty much looking at the trio quite possibly of Clayton Richard, Sean Reed Foley, and Matt Shoemaker. I mean, that looks pretty tasty, no?
Yeah, Nico Goodrum, a guy that I have in, I think he's my most owned player this year. I have him in almost every draft that I've done.
Nice.
I've done 26 drafts, and I think I've got Goodrum in like 18 or 19 of them. I think he's going to hit cleanup for the Tigers, and he got some speed. So, yeah, excited for that opening series, four-game series against the Blue Jays. Hopefully he can get off to a good start and kind of, yeah, you know, plant some roots into that cleanup hole.
You know, it's interesting. Jake Junis, who somebody that really came on strong in the second half, I know he was kind of hurt and he was getting absolutely destroyed last year. He's been looking good in the spring. He kicks off with a pretty nice schedule. He gets the White Sox at home. Then he gets Detroit on the road, and he gets Seattle early in the third week. So may have a two starts in week three. I think if he's sitting there still in one of your deep leagues, 15 teamers and waiver wires, and maybe even 12 teamers if you need the start, I don't think he's a bad at it all.
Yeah, no, I'm in on Jake Junis. Got definitely some of him. Another guy with a similar situation is Trevor Cahill, who will start opening day in Oakland, which is a little bit scary, but he's a good ground ball guy, right? And the big thing that you're fearing with Oakland is the power. But Cahill does keep the ball on the ground, can get strikeouts, and Oakland is a little bit susceptible to that. So I like him. And then he gets a good two-start week in week two, I believe, in Seattle and then at home against – I can't recall who it is.
Texas.
Texas.
Yeah, and not in the red hot sun.
Yeah, no, that's great. All those guys like Odor and Gallo and Chu. I mean, all those guys strike out a bunch. So, yeah, I think Cahill, if he's on your waiver wire, he's worth a pickup, if only for these first 2 weeks, and then kind of go from there.
Yeah, I mean, one more guy I wanted to mention, Yonny Chirinos. I know he's not a big upside strikeout guy. I mean, I don't know how they're going to work the bulk innings and everything like that, but in week two. They're basically starting Monday. He's going to get Colorado at home and then at San Francisco. And I don't know about you, but anytime I see at San Francisco on the schedule, like, I'm attacking it DFS season long, the whole bit.
Yeah. Matt Strom opens up against them along with Chris Paddock, two guys that I'm pretty high on, especially before the helium machine really got a hold of Paddock. So yeah, a lot of schedule grinding. I think, I'm still learning this whole season-long thing, but one thing that I really learned last year that I'm guessing you'll agree with is it's really a week-to-week game, right? You're just trying to put up big numbers for your team each week, and for the most part, worry about future weeks when they come.
Yeah, I mean, it's even a half-week game depending on the format you're playing. Right. I mean, if NFBC, we talk about it all the time. I mean, you're looking at some of these guys like, oh, these split platoon players, all the Hunter Renfros, the Jake Lambs of the world, the Justin Boers, like, we pretty much know their splits really well. And you see a lefty like Boer or Lamb who are power hitting lefties, with a weekend coming up and they're in Coors and it's three righties or even two righties, they're an auto play. It's not something you really have to overthink. There are going to be a lot of other tougher decisions we'll have to make all year, but something like that is just a slam dunk. And so that's a big reason why I like a lot of those platoon type guys.
No doubt about it. Let's do a brief discussion of FAB. I'm sure I can learn a few things from you here. We did have our first, for the online championships that we did, those are the kind of the $350 buy-in, big pool NFBC prizes. I had people in my league spend, one guy spent $896 of his $1,000 of FAB for the whole year. Like, people forget this is a 6 month season. I mean, I think the most that I spent in my 8 online championships was like $40 in total. So are you conservative with that money? I'm kind of torn on it because, for one, there are more, I think, more valuable players available early on. One, because they can impact your team for an entire season if you pick them up early on and they break out. And two, you know, I mean, those valuable players that are performing well are just going to generally get, you know, snapped up before you can get there. So how do you approach Fab? Is it you have an aggressive approach, a conservative approach? Just kind of interested in your approach to that.
I mean, for me, it's kind of a balance, really, because, you know, people that are just sitting around waiting to see how their stats work out in May, it really doesn't work out for them usually. And at the same time, I don't want to be overly aggressive because I want to have enough money in that last month of the season. If I'm competing, I want to be able to throw an extra dollar than what my other people in my league have on a starting pitcher going twice if I need strikeouts or wins and things like that. So I really kind of pick my spots of where I spend money. What I'll always do is after I put my bids in, I'll always, you know, step away. And as silly as it sounds, I think it's important because then you come back and it feels like you're looking at a fresh set of bids. And then you can notice, hey, you know what? I'm going too high here. It's too low there. And I try to figure out what I think my league mates need or what they're going to be doing. But early in the season, like right now, we just did a bunch of drafts, but there's some drafts I hadn't, you know, that I was doing in early March where I need to fit holes for, you know,
right.
For example, I have Matt Olson on a couple of teams. Thankfully I have somebody that has his back there. I can pop in a CJ Krohn or a Wilmer Flores for, you know, for the weekend. But just because I have that situation doesn't mean I'm going to go nuts and spend, you know, 600 on Jun Ho Kang just because, you know, I'm missing my first baseman. So I kind of pick my spots there. I mean, there were some early drafts where Ryan McMahon was available. I didn't go too crazy on him. I saw some people spend $200+ on him. For me, a guy in a platoon situation like that, even though he's in Coors, I put in a fair $55 bid, and just so happens the guy that I beat put in 53. So hey, yeah. If I didn't have him, I'd have Jun Ho Kang behind him for like $50. So for me, it's all about being able to have a backup plan at each spot. So I'm usually always putting in a lot of conditional bids if I have a drop. If there's somebody I'm dropping, I want to put 5-6 conditional bids in. The smaller ones can be for $1 or $2, just so I'm getting somebody that I could potentially be using and not take a zero.
That's exactly my approach. I did a couple of those online championships in February. So by this time, you know, you've got 3 or 4 guys that you need to find replacements for this opening week. And so that, you know, that's basically was my approach. I kind of made a list of players that I need to drop to replace and the position that I need to replace them. And then, you know, you have your first and second options. Maybe you're putting $30-$40 on them. But then, like you mentioned, I mean, I was putting I had 8 different conditional bids on the guys that I want to drop just to make sure that you get somebody that can fill that spot for week one.
Yeah. I mean, same thing. Like you really need to really sort of feel your league out. I know that's hard to do early on in the season, but the last thing you want to be doing is, you know, spending half your salary for something, or the people that went crazy on Greg Holland. I mean, obviously they probably needed a closer, but let's hope it's not a Jacob Parton situation and it's, you know, ends up being Bradley or Hirano in a couple of weeks.
Let's hope it is.
you got some Holland?
No. I don't have any Holland.
So. I'll have them spend their money. I got it. But you know, like another situation where I drafted on Saturday and Sunday in the main events, and I ended up with a couple of Chance Cisco because I'm punting catcher and he gets sent down to AAA because the Orioles are morons. Well, what do? I bid a couple of bucks on, like, you know, 8 different guys, ended up having Swihart as my top bid and got him for $1 or $2. But if you're looking at that type of situation, it should be pretty common sense where, hey, listen, you know, there is nobody else really going after a catcher because they've all drafted their catchers. I'm the only one who's had a catcher sent down to AAA. I don't need to go more than $1 or $2 for all these bums, pretty much.
Yeah. One thing I found that I was doing last year that was a mistake was I was overbidding on these replacement type players that I needed to fill out my roster, but that, you know, other people weren't going to have much interest in. Generally, those types of players, like these backup catchers that you and I are going to be streaming all year long, they're going for like $2, right? You don't need to bid like 11 on these guys. Just throw in a $2 or $3 bid for, you know, 6 different guys, because it doesn't really matter who you get. You just want someone to plug in that lineup.
Yeah, and the other thing I was going to say is always be careful of overspending for somebody coming off a hot week. This is just what people do by human nature. Like, for example, this week, you know, you're hurting a catcher. Martin Maldonado hits 3 home runs this week. Well, guess what? He's going to go for $150 in some league. and he's probably going to hit 100 with no home runs the following week. And Melvis Viora or whatever that dude's name is going to start the whole next week. So, right? I mean, don't you see that like almost all the time?
Yeah, unless you, you know, notice some real change in a player. Like you don't get the stats from last week, so be careful overspending for the stats that you're not going to get. I do make exceptions. I know we've been in some leagues together, and when I identify a pitcher that I think is going to break out, I go get that pitcher if my staff needs them. And that's one of the nice things about pitcher and why I draft pitchers late is because I want to have spots available to pick up the breakout stars that I, you know, think I can identify throughout the year.
Yep, for sure. So, yeah, here we go. Opening day is right around the corner. Hope you guys enjoyed this podcast. This is not the last you've seen of us. DC and I will be sporadically popping in, obviously as much as we can to help you guys out and maybe even have some specific fab shows and things like that. So hope you guys enjoy what you're hearing here.
Yeah, let's get to the season. Can't wait to get going.
All right, everybody, good luck and play ball.